why I wanted to say no, but she, it never entered your mind. It was just another job. you did feel a bit out of place, but everybody did. If a man said a man was out there and said he wasn't frightened or nervous, he's telling a lie, say. But you've got to climatize, so to say. I think you got to the point when you hadn't time to think more of that. It was just getting older, see. I'll say we got approximately half a mile before we got out of the range, see.
So that was across a couple of German front lines.
Yes. Oh, they're well across the German front line. There were Germans lying all over there, see.
What state were the German lines in?
Oh, they were back at the hill, see. Both were all bombardment, see. Because before the Duomo, all the batteries was registered on them. They knew exactly the range and so forth, see. And all the first bombardment from all the moon was all dead on German front lines, see. Wiped out, you know, the German trench. Hundreds of German dead there, see, knocked out, see.
Those are the words being spoken by a man called George Coles, and he's talking in 1986, late in his life, about a day that had occurred 70 years earlier, on the 15th of September 1916, a day that we relate most of all to the introduction of the tanks on the Somme battlefield. And he's talking about the attack on the German-held village of Martinpuich. And it's a village that in this week's podcast with me, Terry Wenham, Tales from the Battlefields, we're going to walk the battlefield that George did, following up on the tank attack all those years ago. I visited the Somme a couple of weeks ago whilst guiding some Australian guests for Terry's tours. As anyone who's been to the Somme will know, it's a very quiet, rural area. Everyone's always amazed because we don't see many of the locals going about their business. The odd farmer, the odd car will pass you. But when we walked those quiet lanes from Buzantine, which was the jumping off position for the BEF on the 15th of September 1916, towards Martinpuich, it took us about three quarters of an hour, I suppose. And as we did so, I read some of the accounts from the people that were there. It was so, so different to the noise and the smoke and the fire and the death, mainly for Germans, that occurred on that day in 1916. This week's episode, a bit like last week really, was recorded mostly on the battlefield, not just at Martinpuich. We started our journey well behind the lines in a small town called St. Paul. We follow the journey of probably the most famous Commonwealth soldier of all, the Unknown Warrior. I say he's the most famous, but of course we don't know who he is. The man who was exhumed from the battlefields in 1920 and brought back to his final resting place in Westminster Abbey. We found the place in that town of St. Paul where he began his final journey. We find a memorial. And then our journey takes us to several key locations and cemeteries on the Somme battlefield. We visit the graves of individual soldiers and find out their story. We look at the battlefield of the Somme, as usual, not through the eyes of the history books or the generals or the politicians, but through the eyes of the men that were there. And we look at it through our eyes 110 years later. So the recording starts, as I say, in that town of St. Paul, where, as usual, when we visit the battlefields, we find much, much more than what we expected, including the terrible, awful, tragic story of three men from the Durham Light Infantry whose graves are in St. Paul, who didn't die in the fighting, but were shot at dawn. Let's go and find out what their story was, shall we? We're about an hour from Calais, and this is one of the French national cemeteries
holds the remains of soldiers who died for France during the Artois battles between 1914 and 1918, and it was created close to several temporary hospitals, and the military cemetery was developed here in 1924, so several years after the war. And the French have brought in the mortal remains, it says, of bodies that were exhumed in the Artois area, and there are 724 French soldiers here beneath the French crosses, and one Belgian soldier here. And then when we turn round, we've got the Commonwealth War Graves Commission plot. This town of St. Paul, we're 29 kilometres southwest of Béthune and 34 kilometres west-northwest of Arras, so well behind the lines. And the communal cemetery extension that we're standing on now, it's built on high ground next to the old communal cemetery. And this place was an administrative centre during the whole of the war. It was taken over by British troops and the French in the March of 1916. And we've got a stationary hospital that was posted on the racecourse near the town. And that was here for 3 years, between June 1916 and June 1919. Part of the British cemetery here was added to the French graves in March of 1916 and was used until April 1918. And it was designed by one of the lesser known Commonwealth War Graves Commission architects, a man called Arthur James Scott Hutton. And it's not a big cemetery. There's just 226 soldiers that died here from the First World War. And all of them have got identities. There's 209 from the UK, 7 Canadians, 4 New Zealanders, 3 Australians, 1 Indian, and 1 South African. But the reason that we've come here to this cemetery on our journey today is to visit 3 graves of men that are buried together, and they're in Row D. Commonwealth War Graves Commission have talked over the last few months and years about black spot, which is affecting the Portland headstones, and is making them dirty. And we can see evidence here of black spot in this cemetery. The commission are gradually getting round to finding ways of cleaning up these headstones. But we can see here that it is badly, black spot is, you can see, this disease that's affecting the limestone. The commissioner going through a process of cleaning them up at the moment.
Does it actually destroy the stone, or is it
just... No, it just makes it dirty.
Just, on the face of it.
Yeah, here they are.
See, I think they look better when they're like this, though.
Well, that's how they would have looked.
Yes, that's how I think
when they were first built, and they're part of history. It's only in the last 30 years we've been using chemicals to make them look nice and sparkly.
I think they should look,
but they're part of the history, aren't they?
Should look old.
These are the 3 lads here. So we can see that, starting with stones, Lance Sergeant 19/647 JW Stones, Durham Light Infantry. He was 26 years old when he was executed on the 18th of January 1917. And next to him, we've got Lance Corporal Goggins from the same unit, same date of death. And then we've got McDonald, another Lance Corporal, again, the same date of death. He was 28 years old. And what it doesn't tell us, they've all got the Christian cross. There's no family inscription for any of them. And it doesn't tell us, as they none of them do, of the 306 men that were executed, that they were killed. You wouldn't know by looking at their headstone that they'd been shot at dawn. Now, if we start with Stones, whose headstone I'm looking at now, he came from Crook in County Durham. His wife was called Elizabeth. And then there's Lance Corporal John McDonald, the third one, executed for quitting his post. And he came from Sunderland on the 26th of November 1916 in the sparsely held part of the line at Rocklincourt near Arras. So this is a quiet area in 1916. They'd been frequently subjected to the detonation of mines. An officer led a nighttime patrol to the King's Crater, a crater that had been blown before, only 50 yards away from the enemy front line. There, a German raiding party shot and wounded the officer and Stones, and he left his rifle and made off towards the rear to give the alarm, but he was arrested by the military police at an official stop. Nearby, in another section of the same line, a party of six men made off, headed by Goggins and MacDonald, who, without their rifles, they'd thrown away their rifles, and they reached a sentry post some 200 yards behind the front line. Now, the trial of these NCOs was held together on the same day, Christmas Eve of 1916. Now, it wasn't just them, there were four private soldiers. It was confirmed on behalf of Stones at the time of his arrest, he'd been in a nervous state, he had difficulty in walking, but the battalion doctor reported the absence of organic disorder. Despite Stone's good fighting record, he was sentenced to death. In respect of the six men, led by Goggins and MacDonald, all were charged with quitting their posts. There was evidence of an unauthorised order to retire, but all six received the same sentence as Stone's. Against a background of prejudice against Bantam battalions, this was a Bantam battalion, these are the small soldiers, the divisional commander described Goggins and MacDonald as mentally and physically degenerate. When it went up to Haig, commander-in-chief at that time, by this time, Haig had to sign off all executions. He commuted the service sentences of the four privates to imprisonment for 15 years, all suspended sentences, because he needed them back in uniform and on the front line. This is, you know, the end of 1916, after the Battle of the Somme.
Cool.
These ones, as NCOs, you know, two of them were lance corporals, so you know, the lowest NCO rank you could be, but he's held them responsible. We know that Stones had got, you know, he could hardly walk. This is the beginning of 1917. The Battle of the Somme has gone very badly. They don't know what's ahead. And they've decided to make an example of these three men. And they were shot and buried here together. And here they sit, listening to the bird song. So we're still in the small town of St. Paul. And we've come to a place which, when we look round, looks pretty insignificant. There's a local French memorial here listing the names of the French soldiers from this town. And there's something else I've just noticed here, John, behind us, a memorial to General de Gaulle. There's a memorial here to the leader of the Free French, remembered from the Second World War, Charles de Gaulle. It says it's a cross. And it says 1890 to 1970. But the modern railway station sits behind us. And it's that railway station that's really brought us here, because the unknown warrior that now lies in Westminster Abbey, this is part of that unknown soldier's final journey. There's a small memorial here, which has a Royal British Legion wreath, poppy wreath in front of it. The memorial simply says the body of the British unknown warrior was selected at St. Paul on the night of the 7th and the 8th of November 1920 and was taken to Westminster Abbey and interned there on the 11th of November 1920. And then it says the same thing in French. And behind us, as I say, is that modern railway station, which would have looked very different in 1920, but that's where the unknown warrior left France for the final time. And then there's an information board here as well. And it tells us the idea of the entombed unknown warrior came as early as 1916. And as we know, through listening to John Nicol, been on the podcast a couple of times, talking about his book, it was the Reverend David Railton that came up with the idea. So if you want to know more about that, then go back and listen to the podcast that I've done with John. You'll find out more detail about that. And the board tells us, for many families, the homecoming of this unidentified soldier represented a son, a brother, a husband or a father lost during the war and would finally allow them to grieve in their own way, knowing that in Westminster Abbey, one of those men lost to the battlefield. It could be them. It could be him. Brigadier General Wyatt of the British forces in France and Flanders, as well as director of the War Graves, the Imperial War Graves Commission, as it was then, was placed in charge of the mission. And on the 7th of November 1920, he had four bodies exhumed from areas where the BEF had fought, from the Somme, from the Aisne, from Arras, and from Ypres. Wyatt issued specific instructions to those responsible for carrying out his orders, and one officer and two men were equipped with shovels for each location. This was to be done in secret, of course. That was the whole point. The body should be exhumed from a grave bearing the inscription, "An unknown British soldier." The bodies should already be reduced to a skeletal state, and no element should allow the body to be identified. None of the detachments that he had issued orders to knew how important their mission was, and the exhumed bodies were placed in sacks, covered with a Union Jack, and then transported in the late afternoon to this town of St. Paul, where the Directorate of Graves Registration and Inquiries was based at that time. Specific timings ensured the four convoys did not pass each other. These unknown soldiers were not to meet. On arrival, the bodies were re-examined and then taken to a chapel. Midnight, a small group of officers gathered near the chapel. Colonel Gell and Brigadier Wyatt entered. Wyatt chose one of the four skeletons at random, and prior to leaving the officer's place, the chosen remained in a coffin, transforming the fallen soldier and into that immortal British unknown warrior. The other three bodies were buried in secret locations, but there are many theories as to where. Were they buried in one of the two cemeteries here in St. Paul, one we've just visited, or maybe along the Albert Bapaume Road? On the morning of the 8th of November, a memorial service was held, after which the coffin was transported in a British Army ambulance, along with sacks of earth from the various battlefields, up to Boulogne. The plain coffin arrived at the castle around 3 a.m. the following morning, where it was watched over by several French soldiers. And then on the 10th, the pinewood coffin used to transport the warrior was placed inside another made from an oak tree donated by King George that had grown in Hampton Park. On this new casket, a plaque was fixed bearing the inscription, "A British warrior who fell in the Great War 1914-18 for King and Country." It was then taken to the harbour under a French and British escort, followed somberly by Marshal Foch and General McDonough, where it was loaded onto a British destroyer, HMS Verdun. And on the evening of the 10th, the coffin arrived at Dover. It went by train to London, to Victoria Station, and that unknown warrior was buried among the kings in Westminster Abbey at 11 o'clock a.m. on the 11th of November 1920, the very same day that the French did exactly the same. They interned their own unknown warrior in Paris beneath the Arc de Triomphe. And then next to the unknown warrior memorial, there's another even smaller memorial which celebrates the 10th anniversary of the town twinning St. Paul, where I am now, with Hebden Bridge. That's dated the 2nd of June 1990. And we know from visiting the cemetery that we've just been in with the three guys from the Durham Light Infantry were shot at dawn. We know, therefore, that the Durham Light Infantry were here in the First World War. Hebden Bridge is in Durham, so I suppose that's where the connection is. And this area in front of the station is a Garden of Remembrance, which is why General de Gaulle is remembered here alongside the unknown warrior and the French fallen from the First World War as well.
So we then moved on to the Somme battlefield on the following day. We've done a couple of podcasts in the past about fighting in High Wood, but we haven't actually visited the London Cemetery in extension, which lies just outside High Wood, and that was to be our next visit, where, as before, we discovered more than we'd bargained for.
When you come in the main gate, the first thing you see is that from September 1916, 47 men, ironically, because it was the 47th Division that took this area, were buried in a large shell hole. And then they brought in an additional 54 graves at the time of the armistice, and it meant that there was just 101 graves here. But this is now a concentration cemetery where burials have been brought in from small scattered cemeteries and scattered burials all over the area. And it's now, this cemetery, the third largest on the Somme, right next to High Wood. There's now 3,873 First World War graves here, and incredibly over 3,100 of them are unknown. They may know on the headstone a regiment that a soldier came from, but that's all. Maybe they found the cap badge, but not enough to identify the individual soldier. And when we come here, there's excellent views across the valley to the west and the routes that the British infantry attacked over for 2 months before they finally took High Wood on the 15th of September.
And I'm standing here with a grave in what was that mass grave, a shell hole, looking down at a headstone that has two names on it, a Captain A.G. Gould from the London Regiment who died on the 15th of September. But there's two cap badges, and above him is Captain David Henderson, who also died on that same day during the Battle of Flers-Courcelette. He was the eldest son of the leader of the British Labour Party at that time, a man called Arthur Henderson. And although he was in the Labour Party, they'd formed a coalition with the Liberals, and he held a cabinet rank, the first member of the Labour Party to do so. And he was actually leader of the Labour Party three times, but he lost his son here on the 15th of September 1916. And ironically, the Prime Minister Asquith lost his son on the same day, Raymond Asquith. He's buried about 2 miles away at Gullimont Road Cemetery. And the personal inscription that Arthur Henderson chose for his son, or the family chose for his son, it says, "Peace was the prize of all his toil and care." We remember David Henderson like we remember all of the men buried in this cemetery, including 165 men buried behind the Cross of Sacrifice that didn't die in the First World War, but died in the Second World War, as the fighting once again returned to the Somme battlefields. In this elevated position in the London Cemetery and extension, late afternoon now, early March. We are favoured today with beautiful sunshine, hardly a breath of wind, no clouds in the sky, and it allows us from this elevated position to see the battlefield all around us. To my left, looking south, I can see the even bigger Caterpillar Valley Cemetery with over 5,500 burials, many of those concentrated. The leaves not yet on the trees. The trees are still bare. Allows us to see in the woods. So this is Albert Alexander, isn't it? Yeah. Albert enlisted in 1915, went to Egypt. In September 1916, he was transferred to the 59th Battalion. He was promoted to corporal 1st of October and killed on the 12th. Of October, 12th of December, 23 years old, and we know how he died because there was a letter sent home. On the 12th of December, Curry and I were on our fatigues, curring duckboards to the sunken road between reserve and support trenches. So there's no fighting. I was 30 yards from him. A whiz bang came and killed him instantly. They always die instantly. I saw him fall and twice afterwards. As I passed the spot, I saw him lying dead on the ground. I did not see him buried, but the next day I saw his grave with a cross on it. Okay. That may not have been here. No. He may have been concentrated from someone else. Other witnesses gave similar descriptions of the circumstances of death, but with varying locations of the incident. It doesn't matter, but it happened near Le Transloy.
Oh, yeah, where Adelaide was.
Yeah. So that's probably where he was buried initially and then brought back here. And we think of Newfoundland Park and those Newfoundlanders that went over. And I mentioned that there was one guy that fell at Beaumont Hamel, which is probably about 10 miles from here maybe, but he's buried here. And that's because, like we said earlier, that they've kept this and Sayre No. 2 cemetery open for years after the war for new burials.
Right.
The other cemeteries being full up. And that's why when they found his body, later on, they brought him here, Martin Cahill. So many of them unknown. So he's not the only one. So we've now found the grave of Martin Cahill. B Company Newfoundland Regiment, died 1st of July 1916, aged 25. But then, as we look to his left, there are two other lads that they found, no doubt, with him. When we look at the burial record, which I'll do, also from the Royal Newfoundland Regiment that died, no doubt on the same day, but we don't know who they are because they didn't have any identity. So all three of those lads have died at what we now call Newfoundland Park, and you wouldn't expect to find them buried here. The explanation is that this was an open cemetery.
Yes.
So on the way home, I started to think more about Martin Cahill and those other two unidentified soldiers that were buried next to him. I wanted to know more about him, and I was fortunate enough to be able to find a photograph of him, which I'll put on the podcast page of my website, terrystours.co.uk, and then using some technology that's on the Western Front Association website, which I think is only available for paid-up members, I was able to use the burial return. It provides the coordinates where his body was found. And I used those coordinates and the online resource and discovered that his body was found not shortly after the war, not 10 years after the war, but in February of 1936, nearly 20 years after he fell. And Martin Cahill, like so many of those Newfoundlanders, got nowhere near the German lines. If you recall from previous podcasts and from your own knowledge of the First World War, that the Newfoundlanders couldn't move up to their frontline trenches because the communication trenches had been blocked by the dead and the dying of the previous two waves that had gone over the top at 7:30 a.m. on the 1st of July 1916. They had to move across the open ground. And Martin Cahill didn't even reach his own front line because the coordinates show that he was killed about 200 yards behind the Newfoundlanders and British front line on that day. It's a location that's easy to spot because the trenches have been preserved there. As you walk through the park, you walk down the path from the caribou, as you walk past the now shallow trenches of the support and reserve trenches, you look across to the right towards the visitors' building that's there, and that's where Martin was killed, probably by machine gun fire. And that's where his body lay for 20 years. The park was opened in 1925. The battlefield had been searched and cleared on various occasions, but somehow his body was missed until that day in February of 1936, where he and two others unknown were found just a few yards away, their bodies exhumed, identified, well, Martin's was anyway, and taken to the London Cemetery Extension, where we found them.
You know, this is a fantastic cemetery because, again, the views.
Yeah.
There's Martin Puich Church, hopefully where the car still is.
And
Bazantine, we're going to head in that direction now. So the 15th Division and the 47th Division and the 50th Division have all come across on the 15th September, these fields. Mm. But they've cut down by this time the amount of no man's land there is here.
Yes.
So they're jumping off trenches.
They're
getting closer. They're just beyond the cemetery.
So we left then the London Cemetery and Extension, and we move down to a position that we could see from there, just east of the village of Bazantin-le-Petit. And this was where the attack on the German-held village of Martin Puich began. And we walked along a country lane that goes from Bazantin to Martin Puich, following in the footsteps of those men. And I remembered an incident from about 10 or 15 years ago when I walked down that road. And nestling in the grass on the left-hand side, I could see the familiar rusty colour of something from the First World War, some of that iron harvest. And then, as I parted the grass, I could see an unexploded British Mills grenade. And then there was another and another and another. I think I found about 10 of them in the end. Still dangerous. I didn't touch them. Of course I didn't. I left them there. They weren't there this time. Hopefully they were removed safely. So let's pick up the story once again of the attack on Martin Puich on the 15th of September 1916.
So the 15th
division. This is their objective, the village ahead of us, Martinkowicz, on that day. Their first objective was the sunken road, okay, which is obvious. Just down there, it just sinks down. Two battalions, including the Highland Light Infantry, almost as soon as they went over the top, had to alter their direction to the left to attack this objective. This order for the sharp turn was received just prior to the attack, so there's no opportunity to practice it. Mm-hmm. It simply had to be successful on the day, and fortunately it was perfectly executed. 25 minutes after the attack commenced, one brigade had successfully attacked both Tangle and Bottom trenches, which was at the bottom of the road, along with the sunken road. They could now move on to their final objective. Many surprised Germans surrendered and were taken prisoner, and Factory Lane, their final objective, was reached shortly after. This is all success.
Yep.
And they met up with their neighbouring units. The Germans, for their part, recognised the successful effect of the British bombardment. But a commander of the Bavarian Corps, in reflecting on the events of the offensive when writing later, detected worrying signs. He felt there was more to the loss of Martinkowicz and Fleur than just the success of the British bombardment or even the tactics that had been used. In his opinion, there were several major German weaknesses in the defensive arrangements. They've seen a crack in the German defences for the first time. He felt too many troops protected themselves from the British artillery and stopped fighting.
Uh-huh.
The men themselves felt that to fire their weapons risked betraying their current position. Uh-huh. And far more significant than this lack of shooting and the frequent failures of machine guns, he was of the opinion there was a lack of willpower and a lack of courage amongst it. These are Bavarians, these are not crack Germans, these aren't Prussians or Saxons, these are they're a little bit more gentle in Bavaria. The evidence for this lay in a perceived fact that the men simply surrendered and accepted being captured. In his damning conclusion, certainly without mincing his words, von Stetten stated that to fall unwounded into the hands of the enemy was shameful and left an enduring stain on a soldier's character. Final objectives had been achieved. Patrols went into Martinkowicz at 9:20. He's captured many prisoners, including several officers, and they penetrated right into the village. And an hour later, they got the news the Germans had retired to a ridge 600 yards on the other side of the village, and that was job done.
Yeah.
Until now, they went on to the next objective. Up till now, British casualties had not been heavy, but of course, what did the Germans do? They dropped their artillery down.
Yeah.
The machine gun fire became more intense.
Yeah.
Losses increased. At noon, on learning that Martinkowicz, as far as the church in the main street, was clear of the enemy, General McCracken ordered two brigades to push forward, taking the rest of the village. And that's what they did in the afternoon.
Mm-hmm.
And during the night, they consolidated their position. They were relieved on the 19th.
Okay.
Went back 10 miles west of Albert. Rawlinson sent a telegram to McCracken, and he said, from GOC 4th Army, please convey to my old friends in the 15th Division my congratulations on their splendid performance the day before yesterday. To have captured Martinkowicz after having been in a month in the line is a very fine performance, and I greatly appreciate their gallantry and vigorous spirit.
Mm.
So, you know, this morning, walking around Fleur, we saw victory that came at cost.
Yes.
But here, the cost was much lighter, partly because our tactics worked, the creeping barrage, there were four tanks here.
Yep.
But as we've seen from the German account, they gave up. They put their hands up because they knew then the game was up.
Yeah.
They were scared, basically.
Yeah. Yeah.
And here we are. There's the church down there. That's a Doak's mortar.
Yeah.
British Doak's mortar. Yeah. They put, you know that, what we saw at Delville, at Longueval this morning, that's what they put in them to fire them. 15 in the air at any one moment. That's a Stokes mortar again, and either a shrapnel or a high explosive shell. So just a little bit of information about that Stokes mortar that we saw. We saw two of them lying on the side of the road between Bazantine and Martinkowicz. And this weapon had been invented by a man called Wilfred Stokes, hence the name. And it was adopted by the British Army in mid-1915. And this was because of the stalemate and the development of the trench warfare
they needed a weapon that would be light enough to be moved around the trenches and also be used effectively at close quarters. The large guns, of course, were great for firing at enemy trenches from a long distance away, but the trench mortar, the idea of that, would it would be used in a British trench, an effective range by a highly trained crew would be about 750 yards. And these weapons were so effective that a crew could fire up to 30 rounds a minute. These mortars were full of high explosives. They weighed about 11 pounds. They had a propellant charge. An igniter was attached to its base. It was dropped down the tube and it fired on impact with a striker at the bottom of the mortar itself. And to make it easy to move around, the mortar, the Stokes mortar, could be broken down into three components consisting of the barrel, the base plate and the bipod. So as the idea was, as the soldiers went over the top and took possession of the enemy trenches, they could take the mortar with them, quickly set it up and then beat off any inevitable counterattacks. It was very dangerous then, obviously, and it's still dangerous today. There was no way that we were going to pick up those trench mortars. I know people do, but believe me, it's a foolish thing to do. Photograph them, look at them, but keep your distance.
Bottom of the sunken road, where it flattens out, the trench, German frontline trench, ran across the road. Okay. And there was another trench just a few yards behind called Triangle Trench. And then you get into the village itself. But there was something else in front of the village. That's a bit of a shell.
Yeah, it is, yeah. It's quite a big one, isn't
it? Mm, it's the bottom of it.
Yeah.
So continuing our journey following 15th Scottish Division on the 15th of September 1916. We come to an unusual sight on the Somme, not so unusual on the Ypres salient, but on the Somme the Germans didn't build nearly as many concrete bunkers. But we've discovered one here, just on the western outskirts of the village of Martinpuich, which was the objective for the Scottish Division on the 15th of September, alongside their tanks. But as we've already learned, so many of the Germans put their hands up here and surrendered. And here we've got a semi-circular structure, would you call that? A concrete structure above ground. Almost like a farm building, but it isn't, because it's made of German concrete, reinforced and now covered in moss, and it's surrounded by a modern barbed wire fence. But holding the fence up, the farmer has recycled, because he's used original World War I silent pickets, those picket fences that were invented to replace the wooden stakes that were used to attach the barbed wire to at the beginning of the war. Silent pickets because they could be screwed into the ground by wiring parties in the night without being heard by the enemy, perhaps just a few yards away, and therefore saving hundreds of thousands of lives on both sides of the wire. Oh my word. And then this concrete bunker has been restored and opened up to the public. Quite big, I would say maybe 15 meters long, split into two to allow access, and there's a very low entrance to one of the bunkers, so it's effectively two bunkers split into two, one structure split into two. And as I come inside this very low entrance, it's old corrugated steel holding it up, and at one end of it, hole, aperture, and I would think that was used for observation. You perhaps could have got a rifle through the hole that's there, but certainly not a machine gun. But it does give you a view
of the battlefield that the Germans were trying to defend here. I'll take some photos of this structure and I'll put them on the website, podcast page of my website, terrystours.co.uk. There are signs on the gap in between the two structures that it's been hit by artillery, but considering the amount of artillery that was dropped here during the Battle of the Somme, it's still in one piece, really. Imagine those German defenders in here, hearing the sound of battle outside, but perhaps not realising that those ferocious Scottish fighters are heading up the hill in front of them, up the shallow slope. And worse than that, there's these four mechanical monsters heading their way. The tanks, which they'd have never experienced before. They don't know that either, if they're inside here. And perhaps that's why those men from southern Germany, from Bavaria, put their hands up and surrendered, much to the displeasure of their senior officers. But to be honest, I can't say I blame them. Looking back from the bunker, we see in the distance, towering over the battlefield, high wood. And then we can see Bazentin Wood, where we walk from. And then down in a dip is one of the Commonwealth War Graves Commission cemeteries in Martinbuich, and that's going to be our next stop. This cemetery, it started in November 1916, used by fighting units and field ambulances until the following June. It then reopened in August 1980 when this area was recaptured from the Germans, but nearly all those buried here were killed in the period from the end of the Battle of the Somme to the German withdrawal to the Hindenburg Line, not during the actual battle.
Yeah.
Holding the line in ghastly conditions in the winter of 1916-17 would have been bad enough in a quiet part of the line, but here the British trenches were exposed and communications and supply lines ran across almost impossible ground conditions. And a lot of this area was where the Australians were, as we saw earlier in that winter. Yeah. And then in 1931, bodies of 10 soldiers that had been buried by the Germans were found in the communal cemetery, and they were moved to the British cemetery. Among them were 2nd Lieutenant Noel Blakely, Lance Corporal Alfred May, Private Francis Fielding, and Private James Gallivan, all of the 1st Dorsets, who were killed on the 27th of March 1916, in the course of a German raid on the Wysap on the southern end of Les Boisselles. There's one RAF burial. 2nd Lieutenant William Seller, 98 Squadron, he was shot down in August 1918. And there's 115 burials and commemorations here, 9 of them are unidentified. 4 graves were destroyed by shell fire in 1918, and the soldiers are now represented by special memorials.
Is it these?
Which are just here, aren't they?
Yeah, known to be buried in this cemetery.
Good views of the battlefield to the west can be seen from the high ground behind the Cross of Sacrifice, and that will therefore look out across the battlefield that we've just walked.
Back up to the wood.
Yep, the Germans had 2 cemeteries themselves here. Martinbuich number 1, and guess what the second one was called?
Number 2.
How did you know that? They were situated quite close together at the northeastern village. Of the end of the village, and as happened to almost every German cemetery associated with the 1916 battle, fairly early after the war, these cemeteries were destroyed, the remains were removed with varying degrees of care, and they were moved to other concentration sites, really, at places like Fricourt and Rancourt.
And that concluded our walk around the September 1916 battlefield. It was now late in the afternoon, we'd walked something like 30,000 steps that day, and we were exhausted, so we did what we traditionally do on a battlefield tour. We retired to our billet at the number 56 bed and breakfast at La Boisselle, had a few beers, we had something to eat, and then we went to bed. So thank you very much for tuning in once again to the podcast that I, Terry Wennan, called Tales from the Battlefields. We'll be back next week with another episode, another one which I recorded out on the battlefields around the Arras area. I think that's what we're going to do next week. But so frequently when we talk about the Somme, we talk about disaster and sacrifice and attacks that failed and mistakes made by generals and senior officers. Well, not this week. Just in a few weeks since the disaster of the 1st of July, the British and Commonwealth forces had learned so much. They'd used successfully the Dawn attack in the middle of July at nearby Bazentin, and here they were using tanks and different tactics altogether to force the Germans back. And we pay tribute to those brave men that won the day on the 15th of September 1916. There's no doubt this was a success. It was a springboard for future success, I suppose, especially with the introduction of tanks. But men were lost, as they always are in battle, on both sides, the British and those Bavarian Germans that didn't put their hands up, that fought, they died. And as usual, I'd like to pay tribute to the memory of all of those that died in this battle around Highwood, Martin Pooich, and those that are buried in the cemetery at Martin Pooich, the thousands that are buried, most of them unknown, in the London Cemetery and Extension, and in particular, the man from Newfoundland, Martin Cahill, and his two unidentified comrades whose bodies were found 20 years after they fell. We remember them by the sounding of the last post.